Belarus has always been a country with limited and restricted academic freedoms because, for example, authorities actively try to introduce ideological elements into education. People were self-organizing and those networks of solidarity were kind of developing, and you saw that actually something is really happening and it was not previously. So the next day I decided that's a good idea to leave, and I actually bought the tickets to the first flight that left. When you leave home and you know that it will not be possible for you to get back, you lose this kind of fundament, right?
Fragile Freedom, Researchers in Exile. Academic freedom is often taken for granted, but it's fragile, especially in authoritarian countries. Scientists are being silenced, threatened, and persecuted. In this live podcast series, researchers in exile share their stories with us. Belarus, often referred to as the last dictatorship of Europe, has been under the authoritarian regime of Alexander Lukashenko for more than 20 years. With the COVID-19 pandemic and the massively manipulated elections in 2020, the country's political situation became ever more tense. While the Belarusian people's desire for freedom became increasingly vocal, state repression for critical voices from society and academia intensified.
From Belarus to Germany, here with us today is Dr. Wasil Navumov. Wasil Navumov is a sociologist who had to flee his home country, Belarus, in 2020. With the support of the Philip Schwartz Initiative, a program of the Alexander von Humboldt Foundation for Researchers at Risk, funded by the Federal Foreign Office of Germany, he came to Ruhr University Bochum in 2021. He now works at the CRES, which is the Center for Advanced Internet Studies, and at the Institute of Social Movement in Bochum. Wasil, thank you for being here and sharing your story. Let's go back right to the events in the summer of 2020, 4 years ago. We know it was the election, the presidential election coming up of Alexander Lukashenko. At which moment did you actually realize that you would have to flee your country, to leave your country, your home country, Belarus?
Well, I think that there is exactly the date that I can actually call. It was, I think, 10th of August 2020. When I first heard the news that my colleague Stas Garelik, who we have the same supervisor with, Heiko Plainis from Forschungsstelle Europa, was arrested. So this was the event which made me actually to think whether if this person gets in prison and he starts to speak about like his connections to the Western universities, and probably he can also call my name, and then I could be arrested as well. So the next day, I decided that that's a good idea to leave. And I actually bought the tickets to the first flight that left, I think, on 6 o'clock in the morning next day to Kiev. And then from Kiev, I went to Düsseldorf and to Bochum. Another event, like probably this is a group of events that happened that those days, is really harsh repressions in general that, I mean, that touched almost every person in Belarus. A lot of people were beaten and imprisoned during 3 days between 9th and 11th of 2020 for taking part in the protest against the falsifications of the presidential elections. And the pictures that actually were uploaded on the net, they were horrific because, I mean, people were just simply beaten on the streets. They were kind of injured with stun grenades, etc. And actually, when I was leaving really early in the morning, it was 4 o'clock in the morning, I was passing through the street because the metro was not working at that point to the railroad station. I saw that on the site of the protest, which was really close to my home, it was trade center Riga, there were pots of blood, there were shattered glass, like overturned trash containers. And police was investigated and seen that there were like this do not cross kind of, how it's called, ribbons. So it's also kind of the signs that really bad things happened the previous evening. And I was actually, at the beginning of the protest, I was there at the Trade Center Riga. I was participating in the protest, but when police started coming, I just left. But as my house is really close to the site, I was inspecting from the window how like swarms of policemen were going the way to the Trade Center. And they were like in heavy ammunition with shotguns. And they were actually like shooting people on site. They were breaking the windows of the cars that were blocking the traffic. So, and there were like thousands of them. And you could imagine that, I mean, I had like this also clear picture that these people were really heavily injured after the clash with police.
There has always been during the last, 30 years, I think only the first election of Lukashenko was a free election afterwards. He was labeled the last dictator of Europe. So there had been an opposition, but this time things were different. I think in the lead up to the elections, protests started in May. You just described, I think, the aftermath of August 9th when the election had to take place. And what was so different this time? Because I think the entire country was on the move.
Yes, this is true. I mean, a lot happened previously that actually made this kind of solidarity and backbone of the protest movement to form. First of all, we should certainly recall COVID-19 pandemic. In 2020, Belarus was arguably the only country that took this totally kind of stand, which the presidential administration, they simply did not notice the COVID team. So they said like, okay, nothing is happening. You can go to the streets, etc. Like the social life was continuing. And at some point, Belarus was the only country that was conducting the football championship. And I know that people from Australia were actually looking at the broadcasting through internet, which was really weird. Who could have imagined that? And then there was a parade on the 19th of May, which was also kind of visited by a lot of old people who, you know, like actually the main kind of target of the pandemic, who suffered from that. So, yeah, I mean, and the number of deaths were actually really high. And our statistics that actually did not reflect that. So that was one of the reasons. And people started actually mobilizing themselves. They started gathering money to the victims of the pandemic, and first of all to people who were on the forefront of this struggle against the disease. Those are medical professionals, and people gathered simply to buy them equipment because it was lacking. For example, in Grodno, as I remember, there was the first kind of outbreak, big outbreak, and there were rumors that people are kind of dying on streets and other really, really horrific things. But I mean, the first initiative that emerged was COVID-buy, and people gathered money for that. So after that, these networks of solidarity, that they actually did not disappear. Another thing, another event that actually made me think that something actually really, really has changed was when there was a crisis with water, drinking water in Minsk, in some districts of Minsk, because the water was simply undrinkable at some point because of some catastrophe. We didn't know what happened, but it was contaminated with chemicals. It could not be kind of drank, and it was, you cannot even bathe in that. But our kind of Ministry of Health said everything is wonderful, just don't take this intimidation, just go and drink this water. And people were getting actually infected, and they're going to the hospitals. So again, it was not authorities actually started kind of struggling against the situation. It was various civic initiatives that did that. The same people actually who were active with COVID-19 pandemic, they started gathering funds to help people. They were kind of living their bottles of water in the districts. They were also inviting people to go and bus to the districts which were kind of not touched by this catastrophe. So, I mean, people were self-organizing and those networks of solidarity were kind of developing. And you saw that actually something is really happening and it was not previously. And the third thing, I think, that also made me think that probably these presidential elections will be something else. When there were long lines to put your signature under the names of the candidate to be registered as a presidential candidate, there were long lines. You never actually saw that in Belarus. And so, yeah, those things were happening and society was changing. I think that COVID-19 became this black swan, one of the black swans that actually was behind that.
And strong women tried to take over. We have to mention Svetlana Tsikhanouskaya, who founded the Coordination Council, and everybody could become a member in order to do something. What is the agenda aspect? Were women maybe also sick of, you know, tired of the rule?
Yes, but again, women were always active, but at this time they were more visible, I think. Because, I mean, the presidential candidate like Sergei Tikhanovsky, like Babarika, they were arrested just before the presidential elections, and they're kind of Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, she didn't want to be active. And she always said to them, okay, I'm just a simple person. I'm not a politician. I don't want to deal with that. But I want that my husband will get out of prison. Then there were Kolesnikova, who was one of the participants of headquarters of Viktor Babarika, who actually also decided that, okay, I will go forward and start continuing this presidential campaign. That she also, but she did actually was active, and she said that, okay, let's unite with Tikhanovskaya and with the third person. It was Tsipkala, Veronika Tsipkala, and they were like became that three persons, three graces, as we call them, who actually kind of united these people from other camps and became this force of protest that actually move forward.
You already really clearly depicted the bloodshed. As far as I understood, there were rules that it was you were not allowed to have a free assembly and so on. Everybody who participated in any form of protest could be arrested at least for 14 days. I think in 23, there were more than or nearly 1,500 political prisoners in Belarus. What kind, I think people are very creative. Give us an idea of how they tried to be there and to protest in some form.
You mean in 2020 or previously?
Yeah, in 2020, yeah.
In 2020, yes, people were like going through the walks, through the streets in various kind of districts. They were holding the flags and they were also organizing kind of tea parties in the yards of the right near the houses. Those were also like really small social events that helped to unite people. And I think that they played actually a great role. And also there were a lot of symbols that they used, for example, that could use white, red, white symbols almost everywhere, like on their windows to show that, okay, this is the symbol of solidarity. We are against Lukashenko, etc. So yeah, that symbolical protest was also really important.
We will talk about the ugly face of the dictator a bit later, but let's first get to actually be exiled, because you're somebody who has been abroad before. What is the difference when you actually lose your home?
Yes, this is completely different feeling, because when you leave home and you know that it will not be possible for you to get back, you lose this kind of fundament, right? Something important that was always behind your back, that you kind of aware, okay, everything could go wrong in a foreign country and I could still return back. And right now, I mean, it's a situation when I I'm about to lose my property, my apartment, because there are criminal charges against me, and I face like up to 12 years in prison, and I can even be stripped of my citizenship. It was several days before that the first case of such kind of situation happened to one of the Belarusian activists. So yeah, actually regime tried to kind of make your life more and more difficult even abroad. So, and also like when you leave, you need to kind of to have like some plan, right? And quickly know what you're going to do in next week, next month, next several months. So at least have like this plan for half a year. And yeah, that's pretty, I'm always under psychological pressure. And that's quite difficult thing. And when I first came to Germany, I remember I did not have this plan, and I kind of had to know to get back inside to me and to understand what I'm doing next. So yeah, that has been a challenge.
And you have to build up your life completely new, your social connections, your economic connections, your professional connections. What did you find most difficult?
I think that the personal connections is probably the most difficult thing, because as I left country, I lost any connection to my friends. Two of them are still in Belarus. We have been friends still in the school years, so they're kind of irreplaceable for me. Three of them are abroad, one in Georgia, one in Warsaw, Poland, and another one in Lithuania. So with those who are in Belarus, we completely lost contact, because I feel that they could be endangered by speaking to me. So we just, you know, pass forward the messages through third persons. So yeah, that's pretty difficult. And with those abroad, we also kind of lost, you know, this dynamic of connection, because we are not kind of have the same share, the same environment, share the same picture of reality. Because when we were in Belarus, we had the same background. Right now, we don't. So.
What did help you in establishing a new professional life? Or what would you say would help, exiled researchers?
I think most important thing is to build up on the resources that you already have, that you take from your own country. And when I came, I think that my first really important lesson was given me by Heiko Pleines. When I first came in Germany, it was, I think, 2016. And I was trying to like to build up this also like academic identity still, because there were only 2 years since I kind of finished my PhD. And I spoke to him and said, probably, how do you think, would that make sense if I start actually actively researching and deeply researching German social movements, like instead of like Belarusian one just completely reorient itself? He said, well, you know, you can certainly do that, but simply think that there are more Germans here who actually have more deep knowledge of that, because of their deep knowledge of context and their deep knowledge of language. And here you are really valuable, as long as you really know your own context. You're coming from Belarus, so you should kind of forget about that. So, and I right now I'm just actively using his advice, because I mean, I still have strong knowledge of context, even though I lost this, you know, connection to the field, right? And I don't know really what people feel right now. It's also really important for sociologists. I still understand what is going on, because there are certain past dependency. I understand social and political processes. I can easily read in Belarusian and Russian, and I can follow also the news from Russia, which is also kind of the hegemon who influences Belarus in a really many ways. So yeah, that's was really good advice, although probably it's quite simple one, but it helped me a lot.
I imagine that you are in between languages, in between cultures. I suppose there is a quite huge diasporic community in Europe, in Germany. as a father, what would you say, our children, are they growing up in this in-between third space too?
Yes, that's a good question. And sometimes, you know, I don't know what to think about that. I understand that my children, they have experience of being raised in completely different backgrounds, environments, which I didn't have in my childhood. So any kind of recipe that I would try to use on them will be unsuccessful. So I'm just trying to, you know, to follow what they're doing and try to give them advice sometimes, just to try to guide, but not to, you know, to be, because I don't have like this feeling that I know strategies of success really good, whenever success could be. So yeah, I mean, they definitely in another situation. And I think that my son, I have two sons, and the older one is probably lucky because, I mean, both of them are lucky, but the older one is, he emerged in Belarus, in Germany, in German school, and he went to the first class when he was six, and he started learning German from scratch. It was a difficult process. He didn't want to go to school, but there was Russian kind of kid who actually helped him. And right now there are many Ukrainians children whom my son actually helps. So, you know, those channels of exchange between them, of cultural exchange, language exchanges, I think that's important, that he actually learned German before Ukrainian kids came here. So he's right now, he gets this reputation, right, as a kid who knows German, who actually kind of more or less being integrated, and he helps them, and then they probably will help other children as well. So I think that's good.
But I suppose it's you're also aiming at your sons not losing their Belarusian identity and the connection to an entire culture?
Yes, I did try to speak to them Belarusian language, but that did not work out, unfortunately. But I still made attempts. What I'm trying him to actually to speak about is that he's from Belarus, because sometimes he mixes various countries. Sometimes he says, okay, I'm from Ukraine, I'm from Russia. No, that's important, because there is certain history that your father has, your grandfather has, and we need to kind of to keep this going. And I also try sometimes to speak to him about like political events. Why can't we return to Belarus, for example? And yeah, it's pretty difficult. But yeah, he understands that it's dangerous at least. And he does not kind of ask me to go back. And also he did not, I would say he did not have like this proper kind of life while in Belarus. He only was there for 5 years, and we were actively traveling in various countries.
Growing up internationally.
Yes, yes, yes.
We have to talk about academic freedom, of course, because academics usually are, so to say, critical spirits who often become the first targets in authoritarian societies because they do not accept ideology that easily or pose questions. In the Academic Freedom Index, which assesses academic freedom worldwide, Belarus now is at the bottom 10% of all countries covered. We already talked about 2020. How was the situation before? You know quite a lot of countries from the professional point of view. Could you describe us, where do you think was always a difference?
Yes, I mean, the Belarus has always been a country with limited and restricted academic freedoms. In certain respect, yes, I mean, it could provide quite a decent education in specifically STEM disciplines. But with regards to humanitarian, I think that the situation was always really not good because, for example, authorities actively try to introduce ideological elements into education in historical science, first of all. And they try to make in school books, they try to make certain events look not in an objective way. So yeah, it has been always like that. Also, there was always censorship. For example, you couldn't defend the thesis as long as is a deal dealt with some kind of political events. And third, Belarusian academia and students, kind of in particular, have been used by a regime as resource to kind of to provide legitimacy, because students were always pressed into going to these preliminary elections, and the results of preliminary elections are always being kind of, you know, falsified in the first place. So the students were one of the kind of, like, universities in general were one of the pillars of the authoritarian regime. And that's why, I mean, the freedoms were always restricted. And we can also recall the case with the European Humanities University, actually my alma mater, where I first studied for 3 years. And it was closed by the authorities because they had their certain level of autonomy in deciding who they want to invite as lecturers, for example. And afterwards, European Humanities University relocated to Lithuania.
Yeah, you already mentioned that it's so difficult to stay in contact, not to endanger anyone. Most of the civic and academic society left. There's a huge diasporic community. What do you know about the situation now?
We had a survey with colleagues from Institute of Russian Eurasian Studies in 2022, I think, the year after the war started. And the results were pretty depressive, because those people who stayed in Belarus, some of them were actually dismissed on political grounds. I remember that according to the latest leak from Cyber Partisans, this is the civic initiative that deals with kind of various disruptions. They try to disrupt the databases of the Belarusian regime online. They took information from the Belarusian State University, and it turned out that in this kind of exchange of email in this administration, they named the specific number of people who were expelled on political grounds. 140 students were expelled. 50 people were dismissed, 50 lecturers were dismissed directly on the political grounds, and about 500 of contracts were not renewed, again, on this very, very reason. So, as you can imagine, many people, they turned out in a limbo when they actually can't be employed by universities anymore because of their political position and because of their dismissal by the Belarusian State University, for example. And at the same kind of situation, they probably didn't know languages that good, so they couldn't go to other countries. And this is probably the most difficult group to deal with, to help them, because they have like very limited skill set that cannot be transferred in other countries. So yeah, that's why, I mean, survey was pretty depressive, because people were actually in the comments, they were saying, okay, oh, please help us. How do we deal with that?
Before we talk about how civic society that is still there could be supported, maybe let's have another look at what followed in, you know, the massive repressions from September on. I don't know, the rest of the year 2020. I know you had already left, but what did you hear from those who suffered it, like the philosopher Olga Sparaga and so on? So what do we know about how Lukashenko exerted his power, how the dictatorship showed his ugly face,
Within the country?
Yeah.
I mean, those were pretty blatant use of repressions, like imprisoning people, beating, torturing them. And that's, I think, the same things that Russian regimes also do. Like, I think about 10 people already died while being imprisoned since 2020 protests. And there are also no news about Babarika. I think someone told that he's in really, really bad health shape.
He was one of the candidates who ran against, yeah.
Yes, and a famous person from his team, Kolesnikova, Masha Kolesnikova. She's also in really bad shape, as I know. So they actually just slowly torturing people by creating such conditions that you can't kind of be sane anymore. So that's what is happening. And yeah.
You are an expert on digital technologies and how they might support or how they would, well, it's about the influence of digital technology on society, on social communication. The revolution was in some ways supported by new technologies. On the other hand, it's a curse because we all know that Russia, for example, is very active in employing bots and so on. Was there a hope that with the YouTube clips by the opposition that something could be done? And is there still a chance to use the internet in a supportive way?
Yes. I mean, also one of the things that made those presidential elections really peculiar was this use of digital technologies and specifically like Telegram channels. Initiative that I think proved to be really instrumental in proving the falsification was the voice. Platform, both platform and a channel, bot in Telegram channel, where you could upload the ballots in which way you voted. So you proved the photo, uploaded the photo, and after that, both manual and machinic ways allowed your ballot to be analyzed and then create these kind of statistics for whom you voted, for whom people voted on this or that kind of district. And after that, there was also kind of people who were observing, like observers of these elections various districts themselves. So they have also their own kind of picture. After that, those people kind of compared to statistics and they had more or less, I mean, you know, objective picture of what was happening. And then there was like the third source of information, like commission who actually counts the votes. And at some districts, the kind of this the picture was completely different in two of the sources of information. And it allowed to understand that there were like falsifications. And people actually saw themselves that, okay, our votes were stolen. And that's why it led to the situation when they were like protesting. Then there were also Telegram channels or civic initiatives that organized like help to the people, to victims of repressions. Again, this is like the consequence of these solidarity networks and kind of attracted attention to what was happening. And finally, the third thing that was really important is Nehta Telegram channel, the Telegram channel that had about 2 million subscribers on its kind of peak. And it showed, it kind of covered the situation with protests in the country. And they uploaded a lot of information, what is happening, a lot of videos. And it allowed you to kind of have this feeling that what is happening on this Telegram channel is actually happening all over the country, right? You have the picture, eyes all over the country and videos from all over the country that people were actually beaten on this, like brutally beaten. And you couldn't have kind of be neutral in that situation because when you saw, okay, I can probably close my window, I can stay like completely neutral in the situation, but then you checked your phone. And there is a video that someone is being beaten by police, like brutally in your own yard. And you actually are listening to their screams right now. So yeah, you can't be neutral. And that's why, I mean, a lot of people became mobilized because of that as well.
And then on the other hand, you worked a lot about the ways propaganda from Russia, for example, is spread, disinformation. Maybe you can give us an example of that.
Yes. I mean, first of all, it is Russian pro-Russian Telegram channels and pro-Russian information sources, which are quite popular in Belarus. But those mostly like TV channels, right? Even before 2020, there was a strong presence of Russia, pro-Russian information channels in Belarus, and also pro-Russian narratives that are being also disseminated via Belarusian TV channels. So people could have been indoctrinated by these TV channels. But when the Telegram channels became like, the counter, another alternative source of information became really kind of clash of these two pictures of the world. When we were analyzing, not long ago, the situation with media environments during the war, for example, but it is completely different picture, obviously. But it also says a lot about how Russia tries to create the picture of Ukrainian people, for example, as being manipulated by the West, as being like not independent. There is no even like subject as Ukrainian people. They are completely out of the picture, and then there is administration of Ukraine, which is fascist, which is kind of wants only to get rid of Russia, and then there is like we need to kind of to eradicate them, and we can only further live with Ukraine in peace, because like Ukrainian people does not actually exist. So yeah,
being an expert on these means, you already said that it's so very depressive at the moment and so very deplorable, especially with the war against Ukraine, because Belarus has become even more isolated and as a complicit of Russia. Nevertheless, do you think that there's still a way? Is there still a resilience? Do you have any contacts? You know anything about solidarity going on, or
on behalf of Ukrainians?
No, I mean in Belarus to get rid of Lukashenko, in fact.
Yes, I mean there was a strong support to Ukraine as well, and there is even people who are struggling on the side of Ukraine, like Paul Kalinovskava from Belarus, and there has been also the movement against Russian troops in Belarus itself, like people who were disrupting like the railroads, and there is also like such a kind of thesis that maybe it allowed to a certain extent kind of slow down the movement of Russian forces into the territory of Ukraine. So yeah, those were pretty significant kind of initiatives that created this level of solidarity towards Ukrainians. And when we speak about the movement against Lukashenko within Belarus at this moment, I think that's pretty difficult to say, because again, I lost connection with these people. And but I believe that there is really, really strong anti-Lukashenko attitudes in Belarusian society. It's just that the repressions are so kind of hard that they cannot kind of voice their dissatisfaction with what is happening, because they will be imprisoned and beaten. So people kind of rationally, wait out the pluses and minuses and make decisions based on that. I think so.
Is there anything that gives you hope?
That's a good question. And I think that after relocation, the hope, as a kind of, belief into something that is kind of beyond my area of responsibility, I think that it's lost relevance for me. And right now, I'm more or less have this pragmatic approach, right? That I have the plan, and I have like specific set of actions that I need to do to reach my aims, and then that's it. Because I think that having hope in some respects, or in my situation, it could be, or probably even kind of disruptive, right? When you hope into something or you trust something too much, and then something actually happens that shatters this hope. You become disillusioned, you become dissatisfied, disappointed, and those things that I actually cannot allow myself right now. So yeah, I think this is how it is.
It was already mentioned today that we have to at least dispute or fight for academic freedom. You know what it's like to live in an authoritarian state. You describe the bloodshed, you describe the torture, the vertical structures. What is your advice to young people, maybe even young Germans? Only a few still know what it's like to live in an authoritarian state. How can we fight for democracy every day?
I think the main thing is to really to believe in the principles, in the democratic principles, and actually kind of be aware of exactly what are they. Because sometimes when you prioritize certain principle over others, you lose the whole picture. When you prioritize, for example, the freedom of expression, and you forget that there are other principles, that's probably also not a good thing. But yeah, I don't have the specific advice because I'm completely from another culture. And what we actually had in Belarus, we did not have this feeling of freedom. And what we had, this everlasting, ever-present sense of disciplining yourself, disciplining society, like introducing censorship in new areas, it became more and more like an oppressing on you. And in this sense, I mean, one of the things that I think was important for me when I came in completely another environment, both language and culture-wise, it was in Poland when I was studying my PhD thesis. Previously, I was a kind of similar, familiar background in Lithuania when everyone spoke Russian. In Russia, when everyone spoke Russian, obviously in Belarus as well. So, and in Poland, when we're speaking exclusively in English or Polish language, it was a kind of eye-opening thing for me, because I at one point understood that actually cannot be to such an extent self-confident as to express my own opinion about some things. And I was trying to reflect on that feeling, I understood that it was something that actually goes since my Belarusian kind of background. People are being repressed. They cannot express themselves. They cannot voice their opinion. That's why protests happen, because they feel that their voice are not being heard. They are being silenced. So yeah, I think that this is really important, to express yourself, but at the same time not to lose like the sight of the whole picture and all other democratic principles that you have.
Dr. Nawumo, thank you very much for sharing your experience and your story.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Fragile Freedom. This live podcast series is brought to you by Congressa in collaboration with the Alexander von Humboldt Foundation. Visit our website for more episodes and resources. The project is funded by the Federal Ministry of Education and Research as part of the Science Year 2024, Freedom.